Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Henning Mankell, the author of several novels, most notably the Kurt Wallander novels, of which there are 10 or 11, depending upon whether the Linda Wallander novel counts or not. Several other novels, it looks here, five of which have been translated into English, many, many plays. His material has been filmed in Sweden, his native Sweden. There's also a BBC series about Kurt Wallander that stars Kenneth Branagh that played in the BBC. I don't know if it's played here. The Troubled Man, his latest novel, is the last Kurt Wallander novel. Kurt Wallander is a detective in the city of Ystad.
That's a very good pronunciation.
In southern Sweden, which is, I guess, a lot closer to Copenhagen than it is to Stockholm.
Right. Ystad, that city that I use, is the, you could say, the southern point, not only of Sweden, but also of Scandinavia. And the area that what you can call Wallander County is the southernmost county of Sweden. It is a border country. You could say that the waters south of Sweden are the Rio Grande of Sweden, because on the other side we have the continent, and that is really the border, really.
Well, why did you decide to set, or was that the reason that you decided to set the Wallander series, or at least the first novel, in Ystad? And that, obviously, there's no way of knowing. Did you know you would be writing a series at the time?
No, I didn't know that. But when I chose for what I at that time thought to be one novel, I chose it very carefully, because in the late 80s in Sweden, something happened. And before the end of the 80s, you could always say that, this doesn't happen here, it only happens in the big cities. But that started to change in the 80s. Unfortunately, for example, you could at that time buy any kind of drugs in Ystad that you before had to go to Copenhagen to buy. That was one reason. The second reason I, in a way, already talked about, that this is border country, and there is a special kind of dynamism in border countries, and I wanted to use that too. So it was an idea how to use that specific part of Sweden.
And that also allows him easy access to the continent, because it's just a bridge over into Denmark, right?
Exactly. And at that time there were no bridge, but at that time you still had to take the boat. But today he can drive a car. But there is another thing too. You have a lot of ferry lines from Ystad to Poland, to Germany, and at that time it was also, we still had the East Germany at that time when I wrote the first novel. So big things has happened. And what happened after the fall of the Berlin Wall or the Russian Empire was that we got, for example, a new kind of criminality in Sweden. We get the Russian mob to Sweden, which was a completely new thing. So, well, I came in the right time in a way.
You were a political activist, still are a political activist, but you were an activist in your youth as well, and you also wanted to be a writer. Were those early pre-Wallander novels, did they have political subjects as well?
I guess everything I write in some way has some political substance. As a writer, I am always an intellectual, and as an intellectual, I believe that I have certain kind of responsibility to act or to react to certain things that goes beyond the story I am actually writing. And even from the early 60s, when I was a teenager, I was involved in solidarity work for the liberation of the African colonies, or for against the apartheid system in South Africa, or for that matter in Israel, which is also an apartheid state of today. So I think it came naturally for me to act like this.
What drew you to the crime novel? I understand you said at some point that you wanted to write about racism. Racism is a crime, and therefore it has to be a crime novel. Is that kind of the way the reasoning
went? No, that's exactly precisely the reason why I wrote the first Wallander story. But on the other hand, I strongly believe that crime fiction is one of the oldest literary genres that we have. If you go way back to the ancient Greek drama, and we could take a play, for example, like Medea, that is about a woman who murders her children because of jealousy. If that is not a crime story, I really don't know what a crime story is. So, I mean, this to hold up the mirror of crime to look upon contradictions in a society, that is actually one of the oldest literary genres that exist. And it is in that tradition that I like to work.
Had you read much crime fiction up until that point?
Not specifically. Obviously, I had read Edgar Allan Poe and I had read Sherlock Holmes, which I still enjoy very much. There is a lot of things you can steal from Conan Doyle, by the way. And I still believe that John le Carré is a very important writer of our days and times. But I had not specifically read what you call crime fiction. I read novels, and some of them are supposed to be about crime.
At that point, did you speak English? Could you read English at that point?
Yeah.
How many languages do you speak?
Swedish, Norwegian, English, German, French, Portuguese.
That opens you to a wide variety of reading at the time.
It does. But on the other hand, we should also think about a group of people that are doing in a very important work for mostly very bad payment, and that is the translators. I mean, what the translators mean for all of us, that give us an opening for literature that we otherwise couldn't have been able to read, I think they are a marvelous group of working people that unfortunately get not only very bad payment, but they are very rarely mentioned even in critics, and that is a bad thing. We should stand up and applaud the translators of the world.
What's your relationship with the translation in this case? I know Isabel Allende can speak very good English, but she still writes in Spanish and then works with her translator. How do you do it?
Well, I only write in Swedish, even though I probably today would be able to write something in English and even in Portuguese. But I check the translations that I am able to check. But I can say that out of 500 translations, I guess, that I have been involved in now, I only refused once a translation where the language simply wasn't mine. But this, once again, tells how good the translators are.
And this particular book, Trouble Man, what's the name of the translator?
I think it's Laurie Thompson, and she has translated many of my novels. And it's a good work, as usual.
Henning Mankell, getting back to Kurt Wallander, I understand that you took the name out of the phone book, each of the names. What made you choose a kind of dumpy, overweight, middle-aged detective rather than someone who was maybe a little bit more physically able?
22 years ago, he wasn't that dumpy. He was a little younger, but I would say that was also a time when there still were, it was a time, times were shifting in a way, that you still had a lot of older police officers, detectives, and today I would probably have chosen another one because the main staff of detectives in Sweden today are much younger people. But at that time it seemed to be correct to choose one that had my own age. And so Wallander and I don't have many things in common, but we have the age in common. So it made it easier in a way to deal with the person that at least I knew something about his age.
Well, also it means that on a cultural level, you and he come from the same generation and are able to approach things in a certain similar light.
In a way, but I could also define immediately what were the difference between us. He seemed immediately to me to be a person that had no interest whatsoever in the politics of Sweden or even the world, which I had. And I was merely interested in show the differences you can find in the same generation.
But it's also true that by making him someone without any interest, it means that all of his discoveries, their political discoveries, and therefore you can show him learning rather than him knowing already.
In a way, that's correct. I always, from the beginning, wanted to create a character that is like you and me and the invisible man or woman that is sitting in the control room here, that we are changing the whole time. We will not be the same tomorrow as we are today. And I was interested to see how that man is changing. And I have tried to make him today more radical than when he was young. Normally we say that people get more conservative the older they get. And I say, yeah, maybe, but not all. I can look at myself. And I believe that I'm more radical now than when I was young. And I've always been radical. And why can't an older man also be it? So I decided to make him a little more radical.
Oddly enough, myself and most of my friends and my family have become increasingly radicalized over the past few years, and I think that may be just because of the way the world is working.
In a way, I can accept that too, but I think that no one has reacted negatively to the fact that he is a little more radical, and we have to clarify that when I talk about radical, he's absolutely not red in any way. He's just what we could say he's a liberal. And that is for him a huge, huge step from what he eventually was in the beginning when he was rather conservative, I would say.
Well, it also means that in a book like The Trouble Man, he does have a point of view regarding the characters who are talking politics, which I guess early on he would not have had.
No, that's true. And, you know, he is 60 years old, and when one gets into the 60s, there are certain things happening. And one of the things is that you know that the most important decisions in your life, they are made. It's very rarely that a man who is doing a radio program suddenly would say, no, I will start educating myself to become a doctor. It's very rarely that that happens, I think. And that also means that you start watching backwards a little to see, what did I do with my life? What did I do with my dreams? That can be rather scary for some people. And it is a bit scary for Wallander. And one thing he discovers is the fact that he has not interested himself in politics. He really doesn't have a clue what has been going on in a country like Sweden. And now he has to face it in this last novel.
And why did you choose to end the series then?
Well, I'm conservative enough to believe in periods and dots. I think that everything has to end somewhere. And I wanted to end this while I still was inspired by doing it. I think it would be horrifying to find myself writing on routine or something like that. I think it would be contempt for the reader. So I wanted to stop while I still was thinking it was inspiring. And then, of course, I always have a secret door that I can open, which means that he has a daughter who is a police officer. And if I decide to write about her, then he will always be around somewhere. But for the time being, I would say this is the end of it. And the book is already out in rather many countries, and I'm happy to be able to say that the reaction of this ending has been very respectful and accepted all over.
But this is also the first Wallander novel in many years. I mean, there was 10 years ago there was a collection, so he has not made an appearance for a long time.
No, and I can lay my hand on my heart and say that 10 years ago I really thought I had written the last novel. Then for 5 years I hardly thought about him. But then 5 years ago I started to think about that maybe there was one novel missing, a novel where he was not so much solving a case as he himself was the case, in a way. And this became this novel after some years of thinking.
And the political end of it is in 1982 and involves Sweden's relationship with the United States and the USSR, and submarines skirting around the edges of Sweden. The information in those sections, how researched is that, or is that from your mind?
Oh, it is very well researched. Everything that says that is absolutely true when we talk about the facts. And then, obviously, my conclusions of it is mine, but it is more and more a conclusion that people start to accept. What we are talking about here is huge hypocrisy. that Sweden was always supposed after the Second World War to be neutral, not to be connected with any alliance, and especially not with NATO. In 1982, there was a situation where the military said there was Russian submarines in the middle of Stockholm, really. It was like here in San Francisco to have it inside the bay. The military never got up a submarine, nothing. And today we know for sure it was not Russian submarines. Probably some of the incidents was nothing, but most probably some of the submarines that were there were Americans. And there were American submarines doing some training together with Swedish military, but without the politicians knowing about it. And this is an enormous scandal that we still haven't dealt with, and I think we really have to deal with it.
And the Russian spy, I forgot his name, or actually there are several Russian spies who pop up. Is that fictional, non-fiction?
No, we had the Russian, Swedish Russian spy. His name is Wennerström, who was a colonel, and he was even working in the Swedish embassy as an attaché in Washington. And he was a master spy for the Russians. And we had some others, but it was like no one could even think of the possibility of having an American spy even in Sweden, which probably we had, but we know nothing about it because no one ever thought about it at that time. So maybe it will pop up one day. Someone says that, yes, of course, I was a spy in Sweden.
One would think that if there were Russian spies, there would be American spies, but the Russians were the bad guys and Americans were the good guys. So you didn't think about that.
No, and exactly. And we were supposed to be neutral. Either we would have to look at them all as bad guys or all as good guys. Not as we did now, that one of them was not existing because he was secretly the good guy. I mean, this was a terrifying hypocrisy of Swedish politicians. You remember there was in the 60s something called a U-2 plane that was shot down over Russia. The pilot, I think his name was Powers. They had bases in Norway that was at that time part of NATO. And when they were flying over Russia and started in Norway, they always flew over Sweden, which should have been forbidden. But everyone knew it. But the politicians at the same time, while they were flying over our heads, standing and saying we are neutral. So this is a really bad story in Swedish politics.
Well, where does Sweden exist today in terms of the United States?
I think the relation is very good. I think the relation is good with Russia. We are still not a member of NATO, but I say still we don't need it because now we are cooperating with NATO openly. So I think the time has come now to sort out this terrifying hypocrisy during the Cold War.
In response to any of the politics in your novels, particularly White Lioness, which deals with apartheid, were there any kind of political repercussions? Did things change? Did you open up the dialogue?
I think that this novel, The Troubled Man, where I talk about this thing with the submarines, is definitely a part of a discussion and dialogue today in Sweden. When we talk about the White Lioness, I'm happy to say that for many people told me afterwards that it was the first novel where they really understood what the apartheid system was about, which obviously made me very happy. And you know, that novel was written before we knew the ending of the final steps of the apartheid system. And at that time, when I was living in Mozambique, which is a border country of South Africa, we all knew that if something happens to either Mandela or de Klerk, you will have a civil war. Fortunately, nothing happened to them. But imagine if Mandela would have been murdered, for example, or even de Klerk. We would have had havoc in that country.
In terms of creating a plot, you have the background, of course, of Kurt going through his issues with his family, and then you have disappeared people. How much of that do you sort out before you actually sit down and write?
Everything. There is always a long process before I sit down to write. But when I sit down to write, I can start by writing the ending if I would like to. I can write something in the middle, or I just write from the start to the end. For me, it's important that I shall know everything about the story I'm supposed to tell. Because if I know everything, then I can improvise if something happens on the way. But if I haven't prepared myself, then it's going to be chaos. I hear sometimes authors says that, well, I start writing and see what happens. I don't believe in that. First of all, I don't believe it's true, really. And secondly, I don't believe that it's a good way of telling a story. If you go out together with your friends, let's say to a pub or whatever you have here, and you suddenly say, hey, I'm going to tell you a story. When you say that, you know the ending of the story. That would be ridiculous for you not to know the ending of the story when you say, hey, I would like to tell you guys something. And I believe that's the same with me. I know the ending of the story. I know everything of the story. And that gives me possibilities to improvise if I find out things during the way.
Did you take the same boat rides that he took during the course of the book?
Some of them, yes. Not all of them. But everything that is quoted, for example, that the military said in their diaries, war diaries from that time, I have read myself. And the interesting to read this material is not to read what it says, but it's very interesting to read what it doesn't say. And so I've been sitting there in the archives reading this.
There's a great through moment, and it goes from beginning to end. And you caught me off guard is when he keeps saying, there's something in front of me, but I'm missing it. I know I'm missing it. And you knew what it was from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
In these stories, how do you take pains to ensure that we don't guess?
That shall be my craft, to be able to do it. Oh, it's difficult to say something more clever about that, but I just, if I can't do it, then I should do something else, really. There are also different ways that you can do these things. I'm quite sure that I could write a very thrilling story where you, on the first page, would know everything about what will happen and who has done everything, and then write 500 pages and still make these pages interesting. So this with what is the suspense, what is that catching someone off guard, there are many ways to do that. There are some ways that are maybe more complicated and to me then more interesting. When we talk about the crime fiction I have written, which is about 25% of everything I have written, I'm more interested in the process of thinking than the real action. To me, to send Wallander into an empty room and have him standing there thinking for 10 pages and make that so interesting so the readers continue to read, that is for me the real challenge.
Well, you've said that what interests you is why things happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Henning Mankell, let's talk a little about some of your other work. You have a lot of novels, a huge number of plays, and in fact, in Mozambique, you're the artistic director of Teatro Avenida, which is, I guess, the primary theater company in Maputo, is that correct?
It is the one and only professional theater in the country. Mozambique was liberated from Portuguese colonialism in 75. It's only 35 years ago. And at that time, there were no African theatre, simply because it was forbidden. The black woman who is in charge of the theatre now, at that time, she wasn't even allowed to enter the theatre. This is a very, very long story that we shall not even try to get into, but I have had the privilege to work together with these people to build up the first professional theater, and it has been a wonderful adventure. And it also proves once again for me that the living theater is one of the few meeting places in the world today where language and race and this thing doesn't matter at all. I'm the only white person in the theater, but no one ever thinks of me in that sense. I'm one of those people working there.
When you're selecting plays there, are you looking for political plays? Are you looking for plays that will just get people in a community to laugh together? I guess more than likely you're looking for everything, but is there anything that guides you specifically because it's Mozambique?
Yes, there is one thing absolutely that guides us, and that is when people ask me what's the difference between a theater, let's say, in Sweden or United States and in Mozambique, I would say The difference is not on the stage. The difference is in the audience, because we have to expect that maybe 50% of our audience are illiterate. They don't know how to read and write, which means obviously that the living theater is enormously important for these people. And this is obviously something we have to count on. Then when we chose what to play, we obviously chose good play. I mean, the most important thing is to produce good art. And good art is done by choosing good plays. And we have done a lot of theater from the Western culture. Streetcar Named Desire, it was a wonderful success. But we also do stories that are more African, so we do everything, really. And if you came there and sat down in the audience, if you do not speak Portuguese, which I presume you don't, then you wouldn't understand anything of what is said, but you would understand everything happening on stage, obviously.
In terms of the acting, what kind of training did these actors have?
They really didn't have anything. They were good amateurs, and they were the best in the country. And the rest of the training they have gotten by me and by working with theater. And one of the strong sides with this theater is that I work today with the same people I worked with 20 years ago. The continuity in this work has been enormously important. And I have actors in this theater now that with no problem whatsoever could stand on any stage in San Francisco without making a fool out of themselves. Yeah, we are on our way to build up something important for the future.
Have you played any of your own plays there?
I have written some plays for that theater, and rather many, I think. But when that is necessary, I do that.
And your non-Wallander books, there are several of them. The most recent was The Man from Beijing, and also Kennedy's Brain, Italian Shoes. In looking up the synopses, these are pretty much plot-driven, though they're not crime novels.
They are. I mean, there are so many things to talk about in the times we are living. And I really try to choose stories where I can talk about things that I find questionable in many ways in the world I'm living. And I believe that art literature always has been like that. But mainly, of course, I know that the first thing I have to do, even if I talk about something, a theme that's very important, I know that half of the theme in the book must be the enjoyment for me to talk about it. Otherwise, a reader would throw the book away because he would feel this is not art, this is something else.
Who is Sophia? She's a real girl, and you've written two books about her?
Actually, I've written three books about her. Sophia is today 25, something. Many years ago, I visited the hospital in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique. I don't remember what it was. I was supposed to fetch something. I don't remember. And I caught an eye of a little girl that was sitting in a rusty wheelchair, and she didn't have any legs. And that girl had an enormous charisma, so I don't know. I started to talk to her. And then I went back to talk to her, and we later on became friends, and it showed that she had lost her legs in a landmine accident that actually had killed her sister. It was so horrifying to, in one way, to see what had happened, but on the other side also to see how she managed to survive. So I decided to write some stories about her, and I wrote all in all three novels. The money that I earned from these books, it went to the village where she was living, so it could help out her family and the rest of the village a little. And I still visit her every time I am in Maputo. And she is a true hero of life. I mean, she wasn't killed by this landmine, but she has survived in a beautiful way. And she has two children of her own today, so it's wonderful.
And I Die, But the Memory Lives On. That's a book about the Memory Book Project.
Yes. We all know that the African continent is very hard hit by AIDS. And many of the people dying are young parents that will leave young children with no memories whatsoever of their parents. We all know, you know it, I know it, that if you do not know anything about your parents, it's very difficult to know who yourself are. And then I, 15 years ago, heard about, in Uganda it was, that they were trying to help these dying parents to do write some memory books for their children. But when I heard about that, I thought immediately, how on earth is this going to happen? Because most of these people, they do not know how to read. And I found this so interesting, so I went to Uganda. I once visited a small village that out of Kampala that had been very hard hit by AIDS. And I met there with a girl who was 12 years old, and she came and wanted to show me something. She had a sort of little booklet, I would say some piece of papers made as a book. And when I opened these papers, between the pages I saw a dead pressed blue butterfly. And she said, I had a mother who loved blue butterflies. And I can tell you that this is probably one of the most important books I ever read in my life. Because I understood there are so many, many ways that you can tell who you are. And this is, in a way, a very sad story, but it's also, it tells us that language can be so many things. And I've tried to support that project.
Henning Menkel, last May, you were on a ship going through the Israeli blockade. You were caught, and the ship was caught in international waters. People were killed, and you were deported. You've since said that you are not comfortable about translating your works into Hebrew because of Israel's apartheid policies. What do you see as a solution to what's going on there?
Well, first I would like to correct that. Okay. What I said is, I wrote an article after that I had been deported where I tried to express my anger by saying that the thought had went through my mind to stop my books from being sold in Israel. But I guess everyone understood that what I wanted to say was that express my anger. Of course, not to prohibit my books from being read in the country. That would have been ridiculous. So, obviously, I guess most people understood that this was more of a symbolic, angry reaction. When we talk about the solution to the enormous problem, there are people that say that the only solution would be to have a two-state solution. Well, I'm not quite sure of that. I honestly believe that I think it would have to be a South African solution, in the sense that there must be one state, but where there are no second-class citizens, where everyone is living together. And South Africa has proved that that is possible without a civil war. I don't say that today it doesn't look reasonable that this will happen, but this is what I believe would be the best solution. But how to come there? Well, I don't know, really. It is like Israel and Palestine would need Mandela and Desmond Tutu and de Klerk to sort these things out. But the first thing I think is absolutely necessary. It is to stop the illegal blockade of Gaza, that's one thing, and stop the illegal settlements that is growing up like I don't know what there. We all know that if the United States puts down the foot, then Israel will be into serious problems. So I still would say that it is up to the United States to use the power they have and not going like the cat around the hot porridge, which they, I think, continue to do. As long as they do that, there will be Palestinians killed, there will be Israelis killed. The killing will continue, and that is for sure no solution of anything. Many of my best friends are Jewish people, and I'm happy to see now that more and more Jewish people, even in Israel, are understanding the way that the white people in South Africa once understood. This cannot go on. So a little more hopeful I am today than I was a couple of years ago.
We did not know. I did not know until actually the Israeli writer Amos Oz pointed it out to me that the settlements have been going on through all administrations. It's policy in Israel, no matter who's in charge.
It is true, but then it also means that never mind which administration, they have all been lying, that they say we have stopped the settlement. So everyone has been lying. And it's just to travel a little around, you see, it's terrifying to see. Every year I come back. I can't go back now because I'm deported. But before I could see from one year to another, when I went from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, I saw it was new settlements here. And they are taking more and more of the olive farms from the Palestinians. So there are all reasons to see to that something happens quite soon.
Henning Mankel, your next book apparently is a novel about a Swedish woman who opened a brothel. Is that correct?
There was someone who was going through old Portuguese colonial archives. He was writing a study about some taxes or I don't know what. And he came to me one day and said, I found something very strange here. And then he told me that the years 1895, 96, 97, one of the biggest taxpayers in the country was a Swedish woman who had the biggest brothel in the city. All of a sudden, she's there for 3 years, and then she just disappears all of a sudden. We don't know anything about more than she was Swedish. So to me, it was a challenging idea to write a story based upon the little we know and all that we don't know, and that is exactly what I have done.
And your personal life, you're married to the daughter of the late, great Ingmar Bergman, and I understand you guys used to see movies together. Would he sit there and comment about the movies?
Yeah, yeah. He was living on a remote island, and he had his own little cinema there with a few chairs. But, you know, the absolute last technical equipment, so we could see, I mean, everything. And I think I saw together with him 136 movies in this little cinema. And after the cinema, we always spoke a little about what we had seen. And I made some notes about what we were talking about. And one day, maybe I'll write about it, but I think I will wait quite some time.
Well, you are, according to IMDb, working on a screenplay about him, though.
That's also written already. It's going to be directed by the Danish director Susanne Bier, who got an Oscar this year for the best foreign movie. So I'm very happy with that. And I think she has just now started with a very complicated question of casting.
And when you were with Ingmar Bergman and you saw Woody Allen films, and some of them have reference to Bergman films, what did he think of those?
I think with the references, he laughed a lot. But I know that he was very fond of the work of Woody Allen. He had a lot of respect for the films that Woody Allen did. There is a funny story about these two guys that I'm not quite sure it is true, but if it's true, it is a funny story. They spoke together, and there was an idea that Woody Allen would come and visit him on this island. But then one day Woody Allen realized that there was no asphalt on this island. And then he said, I simply cannot come. If that is true or not, I don't know, but it's a good story anyhow. And they had a lot of mutual respect for each other.
A couple of questions, since I have not read all of your work. Trouble Man features a character named Baiba. Was she in the book Dogs of Riga?
Yes, she was. Okay. There are in this last novel some people from the past that comes back, and she is one of them, and there are someone else too, I think.
You kind of brought them in as a kind of farewell.
Well, not only, because, I mean, this also happens in life. I think it's not that rare that people, when they approach the 60s, that they try also to find people from the past, to meet them again and either to apologize or to talk about certain things. I think that happens, really.
Henning Mankel, you now spend about half your time in Stockholm or in Sweden and half the time in Mozambique. What's Mozambique like these days? There was a civil war for a very long time.
The peace is there to stay. And I remember some years ago when I suddenly realized that people had started to repaint their houses. And I think it was a beautiful sign, because I thought, now people believe in the peace. Because if people believe that the peace is too fragile, they won't paint their houses. But now they were standing painting. And I also believe that the peace is there to stay, and which is obviously must be if you will have any development in the country. Then there is only one problem in the country, and that is poverty. Mozambique is still a terribly poor country, and it will take long time to do something with that. But I think they are into a path now that I will not live long enough to see it. But in 30, 40 years' time, I think that could be a very quite prosperous country. So I'm quite positive to what is happening.
And from your perspective in Sweden and in Africa, looking and now touring the United States, what do you see in this country?
I see what I used to see in the United States. I have been here quite many times during the last 25 years to 30 years. I see still this wonderful thing that people really want to know things about you. People are interested who you are, where you come from, why you are here, and what you are writing. Much more than you would experience in Europe, for example, where people are very much more, you come from there, okay, fine. They're not interested. And this is, I would say, a very strong side in the United States, the interest in others. On the other hand, I can also see, which obviously is a worry, to see more and more poor people, real, real poor people, almost everywhere I visit. I think I know enough about American politics to realize that there are still really no way of general thinking of how to sort these problems out. And I can see that the widening gap in this society is a bit scary.
For those of us watching the gap widening and watching the dialogue between extreme right and right wing, it frightens me that nobody seems to realize, none of these people on the right seem to realize that they lose too, because what you get is a banana republic.
Yes, of course you're right. And I think I know enough about the so-called Tea Party movement to understand that the gap will be so widened that there is no possibility to build any bridges anymore. And it seems that they are I'm sorry to say, but it is a very narrow-minded politic that it scares me, really. And I can only hope that a person like Sarah Palin will not be president of this country, because she stands for things that really would see to that this gap continues to widen, really.
And in Sweden, what is the politics there now? Because, of course, in America, our mainstream media gives one day to a country. I mean, we don't hear anything about the nuclear disaster in Japan, and it's ongoing. It hasn't stopped.
That is obviously another problem here in the United States. It seems to me that the media allows one thought at a time, in a way, and then you change it for something else. I would say that Sweden still is a very decent society to live in, but a society with problems. You have a youth work problem. You have still problems with immigration, where there are racist attitudes. And there are certain many things that are problematic. But we still today have a fairly good economy. We are very, very little in debt. And what I hope for now is that we have a conservative government, which I'm completely opposed to. But I hope that the next election that we will have a red-green government again that sees to that the gap that is also widening in Sweden, that stops widening until it's too late. But basically, I would say that you would have difficulty finding a more decent society than Sweden to live in. And you can also say, of course, that it's easier because it's only 9 million inhabitants, and here you have, 300 million. So maybe this is a continent, this is not a country.
You've written many, many plays. Have any of them been translated into English, and will we be seeing any of them over on this side of the ocean?
Yeah, there has been played translated to English, and I know that they have been performed in England, in Australia. I think there is something going on in Canada now, so we're coming closer to the United States. Maybe next year if I visit you, I can have something more to say.
A number of your books have been adapted for television. That BBC production starring Kenneth Branagh, were you involved with that in any way?
Yes, I was. Kenneth approached me, and we met, and he said that he would very much like to do it. And to me, that was very gratifying, because I think he's an excellent actor, and he's also an excellent director, and he has all the qualities that to me is important. So I say, yes, of course. And I can, by the way, tell you that he has already done three. And I can tell you now as a kind of news that he has decided to do three more. And he will start shooting one in this summer, I think. I'm very happy with the result.
Is the last one going to be The Trouble Man?
I do not think so yet. I think he wants to do other things. I think he wants to leave it open to do even more.
Because Trouble Man has to be the last.
It must be the last, so I guess they will wait.
You've been listening to an interview with Henning Mankell, whose latest novel is The Troubled Man. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.